The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
I'm like this with some bands and some I'm not like this with, but I've heard it my entire life. And sometimes I'm almost like, okay, I know this. I don't, you know, and it's probably not fair, but they're so ingrained in rock music that any radio station you put on, or they're just, even to this day, they're still always there. And I don't like the Freebird joke.
Freebird, I still really, really like. I also like to use it as a measurement of time. Because it's about 7 minutes. So you can use it. It's like, I'm two Freebirds away. I'll call you in a Freebird, you know.
That's a great point.
Keep rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we peel back the curtain to try to figure out why some albums weren't as popular when they were initially released or have just been forgotten about over time. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins, and I love music, not because I'm a musician, but because I'm a fan. My mother used to say that I couldn't go to sleep without the radio on. This was a tradition I kept well into my 20s, and with the love, support, and ill temper of an ex-girlfriend, I was able to move into my 30s without the need to fall asleep to music. I'm joined by Rob Janicki, a fellow music fan, writer, and label owner. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Keith. How are you?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm great. Really excited.
So today we're going to take a look at the self-titled debut album from a rock and roll band from Los Angeles, California. This quartet from Los Angeles was called Broken Homes. Broken Homes were Craig Ross on guitars, Jimmy Ashurst on bass, Craig Aronson on drums, and Mike Doman was the lead singer and principal songwriter. These four rock and roll ruffians played a blues-based brand of rock and roll. They were, by all accounts, one of the hottest bands on the LA music scene in the early to mid-1980s. Here's what Kathy Valentine from the Go-Go's had to say about Broken Homes.
They've been my favorite band in LA for about 3 years now, and I can't wait for them to get famous all over the world because they're just everything a rock and roll band should be.
Rob and I had the chance to speak with bass player Jimmy Ashurst, who told us a little bit about the origins of the band and how he came to be involved with Broken Homes.
I mean, it was Craig's band. You know, I believe Michael arrived through possibly a classified ad in like a magazine like Music Connection. But that was prior to my involvement. And at the time, it was Craig Aronson and his brother, Spencer Aronson, who was in my place. And there was a period back then when things were moving very quickly, and I had only recently picked up a bass guitar, but I sort of fell into it pretty naturally. And so I was just hungry, and I was playing in maybe four or five different things that were going on in Los Angeles. And one of them was like a sort of a mod band throwing back to the British sort of invasion type of thing. And we played a show on the Santa Monica Pier, which was odd but fun. So we were out there on the pier, and then when I was done, there was a note like stuck to my amplifier. I didn't meet these guys. I didn't know who left the note. It was just a note with a phone number saying, hey, call this number, you know, if you want to play, we got a gig at the Roxy. That was like wild to me. The Roxy was like the friggin', you know, Wrigley Field or whatever. You know, it was massive. So, I mean, for me, I, of course, called the number. I think it was Mike who answered. And he said, look, just come down to this rehearsal place and here's the address. You know, I was like really nervous because I hadn't been playing for very long. So I didn't know. And I was very nervous. So I actually ended up bringing my friend who happened to be Mark Ford, who went on later to play with the Black Crowes. So I brought Mark with me for like emotional support. But we went down and I thought it was an audition, which I'd never done. And, you know, Mike was like, look, you know, there is no audition. There's nobody else. We just want you in the band. So that was it. And we ended up down there. I think Mark and I brought a bottle of Jack Daniels or something. But we ended up playing like all night and jamming. And it was like Chuck Berry songs and stuff. We all kind of, it just kind of gelled. And we, like I said, we were in there for fucking hours, like all night. So playing, and that was it. That was the beginning of the Broken Homes for all intents and purposes, you know. And oddly, you know, those of us still alive are still all friends. I talked to Mark, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and Craig, of course. It was a really exciting sort of time for us.
Broken Homes were a four-piece band of brothers, aligned to take the rock and roll world by storm. And if you listen to this self-titled debut, you may be left scratching your head as to why they didn't.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Broken Homes signed with MCA Records, who at the time was headed up by Irving Azoff. From 1983 to 1989, Azoff was the chairman of MCA Music Entertainment Group, and is often credited with turning around the label's fortunes. However, the label wasn't known to have a deep rock and roll bench, with Tom Petty being their biggest rock star at the time.
They didn't have the cachet as being the big rock label.
Broken Homes was signed by rising A&R representative Michael Goldstone, also known as Goldie.
He was young and hungry. He came, you know, very, very interested in the band, and that's why we ended up going with him. He was taking a huge risk, I think, as well.
We asked Greg Ross how Michael Goldstone discovered the band.
We had submitted a demo to a college radio station, and he heard that.
Wow.
It happened so fast, he was really kind of, you know, it wasn't something you really thought about.
This is what Michael Goldstone had to say.
I remember seeing Broken Homes on a Monday night in an empty club with about four people, and being so electrified that I'd walked out of the club, driving around thinking, how am I going to get this band?
Here's Broken Homes producer Jeff Eirich describing what it was like seeing the band live.
I remember going to see you guys in some club downtown where they had a small stage. There was a lot of wood, and Doman was hanging from the rafters, and I forget what club that was. I think Goldie was there, and I told him right away. I said, "Dude, this is right up my alley, man. Let's do it. This is great."
Mike predates Eddie Vedder and hanging from the rafters.
by a while.
Yeah.
In 1986, he may have still been a little green, but his acumen for recognizing talent was certainly spot on.
Michael, I guess, had the foresight to say, "You know what? I'm going to separate myself from everybody else and work with a rock and roll band that just, you know, they're in it for the music." I mean, it really sounds like the timing of him coming in and you guys doing what you did in a sea of other people not doing that.
Yeah.
It's probably, you know, a virtuous thing for you.
Indeed. And it's rare that those all those elements come together at the same time.
Some might even argue he saw in Broken Homes what would be the future of rock music.
Thank you. my neck, but nothing to use it, nothing to lose it with. Well, the rain was pouring down.
The link between Broken Homes and the tsunami of grunge and hard rock that was the 90s is Michael Goldstone. He would leave MCA Records and move to PolyGram Records, where he signed a Seattle group called Mother Love Bone. After the untimely death of their lead singer, Andrew Wood, he signed the remainder of the group to a deal at Epic Records. Those remaining members would become the nucleus of Pearl Jam.
Stars left.
I don't think it can be understated how good this band must have been to get signed to a major label in LA in the mid-80s. No offense to the 90s, you know.
It was harder in the 80s to get signed by a major. The 90s, they were throwing darts at anyone who looked like Kurt Cobain or Eddie Vedder and Chris Cornell, and, you know, they got signed.
If you had a guy farting through a bullhorn, he probably could have landed a deal.
Record labels held all of the cards. There really wasn't a chance for a band to get anywhere without a major record label. They had all the money. They had all the connections. They had all the distribution. They had everything that a band needed to succeed. If they weren't signed, good luck.
What Connie felt, she kept to herself. Pulled into a pretty grove of pines and made ourselves comfortable. Then I heard music.
Producer Jeff Irick in Broken Homes chose Oceanway Studio to record that debut album. And I only know this because I dug around. I didn't know this intuitively. I don't have that much nerd knowledge. But Oceanway Studio has a pretty fabled history. It was initially United Western Recorders, which was one of the most successful independent recording studios of the 60s. According to the book Temples of Sound by Jim Coogan and William Clark, no studio has garnered as many Best Engineering Grammys as United Western. United Western Studio 3 is considered iconic because that's where Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys recorded both Pet Sounds and Smile. I asked producer Jeff Irick why he chose the studio he did.
Oceanway has a big live room. You know, it's a studio, as you say, with a lot of history. But Alan Sides, who was the owner, they've sold it since then. He made the rooms the best they could be and then kind of upgrade the equipment. But Alan is a guy that appreciates vintage gear in perfect shape, all the great microphones. And Mark Edel, who engineered the record, started as a second engineer at Ocean Way. So he knows that room. He knew that room well. So it was the right place to make the record. I did a lot of records at Ocean Way, and I never had anybody say, wow, this studio doesn't feel right. Everybody just, it's impressive when you go in there. So it gets everybody in the right headspace for making a good record.
So you have to imagine, Rob, a young band of brothers, rock and roll, raconteurs, stepping into a studio with that kind of fabled history. I don't know. That's got to be kind of a mind fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. There's no doubt. And at the age that these guys were at the time, so the history inside those walls had to blow them away. Had to be inspirational, too.
Craig, did that sort of, the history of it sort of inspire you, electrify you, or anything like that?
You mean talking about the studio itself?
Yeah, the studio itself.
No, I had no idea. I mean, how many studios had I been in before that? Probably a few demo studios. So at that point in my life, I didn't really have a clue. I'd been in recording studios, and it looked like one for sure. But I can't even remember the gear now and, you know, all that stuff.
And what about you, Jimmy? Did going into a studio like Oceanway have any sort of influence on you as you were recording the debut record?
Man, honestly, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
And now for something completely different.
Before working with producer Jeff Irick, they spent some studio time with a couple of rock and roll legends.
We had been working a little bit in pre-production with Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson. They were originally slated to be the producers of the first record. They came to a show, I think we played in Santa Barbara. And then all of a sudden, here's fucking Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson standing in front of us, and then they came backstage, and we ended up doing some pre-production. In fact, the song I'll Be Wearing Blue on that album was initially Double Time. It was like a country song, like ding 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 ding. It was like that fast, and it was Ian Hunter at a rehearsal, because we were again doing pre-production, so we were rehearsing every day with those two guys in the room. And Ian Hunter said, "Cut the time in half," and you know, we were like, "No." You know, initially, because we were little assholes, but we lived and breathed that band. You know, it was part of what we internalized. It was our identity. There were years where people didn't know my last name. You know, I was just Jimmy from the Broken Homes, and you know, it's just you just absorb that. So when someone from the outside comes in, you get really defensive. At least I did. Sort of last minute.
Producer bassist Jeff Eirich began his career in the early 70s as an LA studio musician and touring sideman. As a bass player, he has played with artists as varied as Tim Buckley, Bette Midler, Tanya Tucker, Air Supply, Rick Springfield, and John Cale.
Pop quiz, Rob. What other famous musician has logged time serving as the wind beneath the divine Miss M's wings?
You got me there. I don't know.
This is the depth of my nerddom. Barry Manilow was her original piano player when she was playing bathhouses in the 70s.
It fits, yep. You know, now knowing that makes sense. As a producer, he scored a hit right out of the gate, producing the seminal debut album by the Plimsolls for Geffen Records. He would go on to produce a who's who of artists, including T-Bone Burnett, The Blasters, and Gun Club, even logging in time producing Cheech and Chong. Eirich has produced numerous soundtracks to films. Again, equally as varied as his playing and production credits. Movies like From Dusk Till Dawn and 80s indie classic Echo Park. When Jeff Eirich produced Broken Home's debut album, he was well-versed on what it took to make a great rock record.
He, for the most part, let us play.
How long did you spend in the studio to record it?
Can you remember, Jeff?
I don't remember that. I mean, to cut those 8 songs, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 days. You know, but we did it. We got the record done. I don't know. You know, and it was Goldstone's call to have Dave Jordan mix it.
For those who don't know, this is a guy who engineered and mixed records by the Talking Heads, Frank Zappa, the Rolling Stones. He produced the first 2 Jane's Addiction records, as well as Alice in Chains. And interestingly enough, I'm a huge Replacements fan, as you know, and my favorite record is Pleased to Meet Me, and apparently he was interviewed by Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson to produce that record, but Dave Jordan happens to be sober, and at the time, those guys were notoriously not sober.
I've been dreaming. dreaming many times before. I keep hoping, hoping I'll never see you anymore.
While Craig Ross, Jimmy Ashurst, Craig Aronson, and Mike Doman were the principals of the band when they got signed, it was producer Jeff Eirich who determined that Aronson's drumming wasn't quite capturing the sound he felt the songs needed.
Making a great rock record, you cannot have drums that are so-so. The drums have to be kicking ass, just like they have to be driving the show. Craig just wasn't ready to make this record.
So Eirich called in Charlie Sexton drummer Don Harvey at the 11th hour. Actually, it was 3 a.m.
I do remember Don coming in his pajamas, and then I remember cutting at least one song live, but I can't remember what we did with the rest of it.
I'm pretty sure we cut those tracks pretty much live. I mean, it was a live band. They were ready to do that. To do otherwise would have been kind of nuts. Because we were at Ocean Way, right, which is a big room. So, I mean, that's why you would take a rock band to Ocean Way.
This is my memory of that whole thing. I'd never heard the band before. Jeff literally woke me up. I was sleeping. I came down, groggy. And I just loved it. And it was one of those rare opportunities to just fucking play without having to just like rehearse and how does this go and how does that go? It was just super, super organic. I mean, how often, I think this is the only time in my life I went into a studio and just like got to rock without knowing what the fuck I was doing or caring. It was just like, okay, I can fucking do this.
Yeah, it went really fast. Right?
That was it. That was my entire Broken Homes experience. It was probably like 8 or 10 hours. Right? That was it.
Yeah, it was really fast.
It's never an easy decision to replace the playing of a band member on an entire album. Harvey handled it all with political precision, and Aronson still got to keep his job. Perhaps more importantly, it was Harvey who gives the album its thundering spine. And if you listen to it, you wouldn't know that the guy was called in at 3 a.m. and had never met the guys before playing live with them in the studio.
Don has a very particular drumming style. I mean, he was in Charlie Sexton's band at the time. Mm-hmm. And those guys were from Texas, man. And it's like, fucking guys in Texas can play, yeah, right? So I was like, shit, I had a good pair of pants on and some cool boots, but that was about it.
The drums are so great on this record.
They really are.
Thank you, Jeff.
So here's a question for both Don and Craig. You played on the album, Don. Was there a chance? Was there thoughts about you joining the band?
No, I don't think so. Craig?
I think at the time it was so sensitive because Craig had been the drummer for so long. So I think everybody that we secretly wanted something like that to happen. But at that very moment, it was just so sensitive that he didn't even play on the record that I don't think we went that far. Though
I was playing with
Craig didn't last very much longer with us.
Yeah, I was playing with Charlie Sexton, so I wasn't.
You were also with Charlie.
The reason why Craig is given the drummer credit on the record was to kind of preserve the image of the band, because they were going to be the band that was promoting the record.
Right.
And that's why Don's credit is a little obscure down below with all the special, with the people that did overdubs and stuff.
Hello there. A flood tide of filth is engulfing our country in the form of newsstand obscenity and is threatening to pervert an entire generation of our American children. We know that once a person is perverted, it is practically impossible for that person to adjust to normal attitudes in regard to sex.
What was the LA music scene before you were signed?
It was like the end of, I guess, punk and that rootsy kind of punk. thing that was going on in LA, and it was before like the thing that exploded, which was the Guns N' Roses and all that. So it was still kind of, it was very clubby and small and super fun, because we, you know, we were still playing at those clubs that used to be like the big punk clubs, and it was all pretty exciting, actually.
There was a huge underground scene going on, and for whatever reason, you know, they jumped on us. And then what followed was a feeding frenzy. So after that, precedent was established, I think, that allowed for all the Sunset Strip sort of themed bands came out of that, at least here in Los Angeles. We were a rock and roll band. You know, we weren't necessarily a Sunset Strip themed band, and aesthetically and sonically and in every way, we were into different stuff. The Georgia Satellite, Jason and the Scorchers in Nashville, you know, that was, it was really inspiring.
And what was that A&R scouting process like? Now, Jeff had told me through an email that you guys were white hot. I think I read you were like 18 or 19?
Yeah, I think so.
What was that like, being courted by major labels?
I mean, it was super awesome. It would beat going to college.
I mean, I was confident that we were something special. And so it just seemed natural to me that, once we started engaging crowds at the level that we had, it seemed logical to me that we should then have management and all the business side of things, which I was completely, it was all foreign to me. So I know that our manager had been, he was close to retirement at that time, and he had been a radio guy or something. And he had arranged for several labels to come down to see us and stuff. And I couldn't tell you who they were, honestly. I mean, I just know the ones we eventually, you know, had to deal with.
Yeah.
I'm Clem Burke, and I think Broken Home's a really great rock band. I think they more or less capture the essence of really what rock and roll is, and they have some of the really great qualities of the 60s and 70s. Rock bands.
Now let's take a look at the album itself and the songs and try and deconstruct why this album was all but abandoned.
Broken Home's self-titled debut was released in August of 1986. All of the songs were written by lead singer Mike Doman, except for two. The closing track, Yes, It's All Over Now, was co-written with guitarist Craig Ross, and Painless Saturday was written by Craig Ross. As the principal songwriter, Doman was certainly someone who had something to say. It's not that what he wrote had the complexity, dexterity, or imagery of someone like Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan, but let's be honest, this is straight-up blues-based rock and roll. What you need is a story, and to be able to tell that story in a simple manner and make it identifiable. Mike Doman did that throughout this debut record. While the lyrics may have been straightforward, there is an honesty, an empathy, and a touch of irony and contradiction throughout the lyrics on the album. Georgia Satellite Dan Baird was a fan.
So Mike Doman writes songs the way I wish I could. I don't endorse orange juice, socks, liquor, or soft drinks, blue jeans, sneakers, or anything, guitars, amps. But I endorse this band because they're a rock and roll band in the latter half of the 1980s, and that's a rare commodity.
Jimmy talked to Rob and I about Mike Doman's creativity and how it influenced and manifested itself in the band.
Michael was the wild card, you know. He came from the East Coast. He was not an L.A. guy. And so he had come some years prior to this, bringing with him the open tunings, the blue-eyed soul of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and, you know, writing songs about, you know, steel towns like Bethlehem Steel and all that. You know, and that infused itself into, you know, what became our records and his, his songs, where he would take on the character, like in Steel Town. He's a steel worker, right? So that has some resonance with the people that it managed to reach the very few people. You know, the rest sort of, you know, what came later was more of a, you know, Sunset Strip and boobs and lyrics about boobs. Experience. That was my first time in a major studio of any kind. I'd never, you know, done any of that. I was sweating it, man, because I saw the drummer go, and so I'm like, man, I'm fucking next. I'm on the chopping block here, unless I, you know, really get it together. So I was just focused on not getting kicked out, you know, really. But you know, there was a certain desperation, I think, to my playing that still is.
Now, I'm not going to proclaim Mike Doman was a rock and roll Tolstoy, but these songs belie a depth and lyrical texture to them that certainly indicated he was a very good songwriter. On the second song, there's a line that still gets me to this day. The second song is L.A. Rain. You would think, as a rock and roller, you know, I've got all these rock songs about 17-year-olds, a little creepy now in hindsight, probably creepy then, but in any event, that's neither here nor there. You've got somebody who's flipping the script and who's attracted to an older woman with ID that says she's younger. I just think that's really clever. And like all the lyrics on Broken Home's debut album, these aren't complicated and they're not obtuse. They're easy and identifiable. And that's the sign of a good songwriter. And it's the benchmark of a good rock and roll band.
You know, Broken Homes is a band that was at face value. That's what they were at that time. If you would have gone to see that show that I saw at Hong Kong Cafe, it sounded a lot like the record did.
When you were promoting the record, you went on tour, presumably. Who did you tour with?
We did the West Coast run with the Replacements.
What?
Yeah. And so
they're one of my favorite bands.
Oh, really? Nice. Mine too.
Yeah, they're incredible.
Ours too. We were super into. I mean, Craig, I think knew more about them than I did. I didn't know much, other than I think I tried to borrow Tommy's amp. I was notorious for that. I didn't really have an amp, and and so I think I did it to Duff at one point, and I did it to Tommy, and they both said no, and I was like, and I was hurt by that. You know, I'm like, what do you mean? You know, no. I can't, I'm sitting right here. I just need to plug my cord in, you know. Come on, you guys. But they weren't having it. You know, I learned about that later. You know, I probably would have let somebody borrow my amp. I don't know. But anyway, I was pissed.
We did an amazing tour where we borrowed a band from Universal Studios, like a big passenger van, jumped in there with Bondo. Do you remember Bondo, Don?
Oh, hell yeah.
He was the driver. In fact, the very first date of the tour, we met at Mike's house because we were going to jump in this van and go to Phoenix, and Bondo showed up 8 hours late. That was the beginning of the tour. So we drove this thing across the country. We played, I remember one show we played somewhere in the Midwest, and there was a blizzard, it was freezing, and they booked us into this big theater, and Goldstone came out to see the show, and it was because of the weather and also, you know, because of promotion. And Goldstone was the only guy in the audience apart from the homeless people who were trying to stay warm up in the balcony.
Oh, wow. Oh, man.
It was a great show. But the end of the tour, though, we did 3 dates, I think, with Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Oh,
well, Bondo worked with Stevie Ray, right?
That's
Bondo,
right.
Stevie Ray's
yes.
guy.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, Stevie Ray helped get Bondo off Smack.
Yeah, which probably would have been after this tour.
Jimmy, when you were promoting the record on tour, did you get paired up with any unusual bands or anything, that any bands or artists that you guys thought were a little odd?
Yeah. Most, actually. The one that made sense was the Stevie Ray Vaughan tour, which we, you know, were amazed that we got, because it was, I think it was a funny moment at the first show, because we'd been advised that we were going to do one show, and that whether Stevie approved or not, he was going to decide that night, you know, whether we would continue. And so we were like, fuck, right? Yeah. So we did the sound check, you know, completely stressed out, like trying to make sure, you know, that we got the timing of everything right. And we're in within that very strict time frame that you're given when you're opening up for a professional artist. And, you know, you don't want to go over, you don't want to go under, and you don't want to fuck them up in any way. And so we were doing that and completely focused on that, thinking, you know, this tonight is going to be the make it or break it. And then we went back to the dressing room, and within a few minutes, there was Stevie Ray Vaughan at the door, and he's like, don't worry, guys, you got it. And he had been watching the sound check. So, wow. Yeah. But I mean, there was I saw a photo just the other day of Craig and I sitting backstage at the Greek Theater here in Los Angeles. And I recall that it was that we'd gotten the gig opening for the Starship. It was like the Jefferson Airplane. It was like, but it was like the really crap version, you know. It was like the we right. built this city thing, and we're like, what the fuck is happening? And then, so I went out on stage. I remember that at the sound check. And I mean, I'm looking around. The Greek is just this stunningly beautiful place to play. It's just, you know, there's forest all around it. It's just gorgeous. And so I was like marveling at that. And then, and there was a rug on the stage. And at some point, I had a glass of water, like a cup of water in it. Like I stepped on it and it tipped over onto the rug. And it turns out that was like Grace Slick's rug. And she got fucking pissed and was like yelling at me. I'm like, who is this? Why is this lady yelling at me? And I'm like, it's just water. You know what I mean? Like fucking. And so anyway, it was another.
Why is my mom yelling at me?
Yeah. So that was that. So that was weird. We're like, what the fuck are we doing here? And we played some other ones. I mean, we did a bunch of shows with NXS, who I actually loved, you know, they were great, but it was a weird crowd wise, you know, they didn't know what to make of us. And so it was always a struggle, man. I mean, it was an uphill battle trying to, you know, again, like I mentioned, Michael jumping in people's laps and things like that. I mean, we were trying to force people to like us, you know, we were like aggressive and, you know, we'd do anything. And, you know, a lot of times there would be no reaction until you finally would connect with the few people who didn't leave.
Harold, my dear, ring for Higgins and have him see if the morning mail has come.
I was about to go out and look for it myself, Tyler.
I said let Higgins do it.
To me, if I had to pick one thing, and I don't want to point a finger, but I'm going to. I just don't want to. If I had to point a finger at anyone why this record sort of got abandoned, to me, it's MCA Records. I think poor marketing, if there was marketing at all.
Sounds like they didn't know what they had.
One thing about MCA Records, that was a monolithic, that's the best word to use, label. They had so many genres, okay?
Major labels typically are to blame when something kind of doesn't happen, marketing or whatever the case, especially a record that's this good. What did the band think when the record was done? Did you guys have an idea or plans that you thought, hey, we really did something good here and this is gonna do something? Was that a discussion or was it just we're making a record and let the label handle it?
Well, then we were so young and naive about the whole situation. There was definitely an expectation that it was going to do well. I mean, we thought, you know, you make the record and then the next step is the obvious next step. You know, I think at that time we were quite naive as far as the way the business worked and maybe didn't have the awareness that we had maybe more control or influence over the direction of things than we knew about. So, you know, it's like a twofold thing. I mean, on the one hand, we thought, yes, the record company was going to take care of that. We were going to tour it and then we're going to be on the radio and everything else that's supposed to come with it. But we thought that that was their job, not ours. I mean, at least from my perspective. And
Yeah. And it should have been. It should have been their job for sure, obviously. But
yeah. And then, you know, our managers that we ended up signing with at the time were, they had been in the business for years, but I think this was their first time managing a band. We were slightly wild with some of our personalities and, you know, and I don't want to point fingers at anybody, but, you know, like most of the problems with the band over that whole career was a lot of mismanagement, you know, in a way, and partly to blame for the band and, you know, for who we chose to represent us. And I know that Goldie, he probably had his hands tied and he was still a kind of a new A&R guy. I mean, he was just getting his feet together. So
Goldstone was a young A&R guy. So in terms of the record company politics, he was at the bottom. You know, his projects weren't going to get the attention that some of them were senior A&R people. Their projects would get priority. And also those projects came with managers who knew the game and, you know, knew what to do to make things happen at MCA. So
it's a little bit of a catch-22 when you sign with a major label as well, because you have the money behind it. You've got, you think, this great marketing plan that's going to happen after the fact. But then, you know, you don't know what they're going to do. And if they can't figure it out, if they're not willing to take some chances, it kind of leaves you in limbo because, you know, you don't really have, nor does, you know, did Goldstone really have the power, I guess. They don't know how to create a scene, so they just try to find a place to plug you in. And with your record, with Broken Homes, it was really hard to do that, especially at the time that it had come out.
The record companies, they don't know, and they still don't know, how to market. Like, what do you market? What's the marketing path for classic rock when it's not yet classic, when it's being made today? You know, there's no path for that. And business people need a clear marketing path.
It really comes down to management and the label to put together a marketing plan that's going to, you know, that's going to be successful. And, you know, I think with MCA, probably at that time, especially, a lot of the marketing plan probably involved getting the record on the radio. But the problem was that label was not, they were geared towards more pop or soul, or, you know, they didn't know what to do with a band like Broken Homes when it came to radio. Their connections with radio stations weren't with the radio stations that were going to be playing Broken Homes. So I hate to say it, but they weren't really ready to put enough money into the radio promotion, what it would have taken to get the record placed, you know, in the right places.
That time period, the mid 80s, heading to the late 80s, music was changing. There was a lot of stuff on the horizon, obviously, again, hindsight being 2020, that maybe because of that, you know, rock music starting to trend differently. Yeah, those major labels did just had no one on the ground. They didn't know what to do with a band like you because you really didn't fit into a box.
We were slightly early in a way.
Completely agree. Yeah.
I mean, the Crows ended up basically using that record as somewhat of a blueprint as far as approach. But, you know, they were how many years later? And that was years of, you know, once rock and LA rock and all that stuff really hit. But we were a few years before that.
What do you think happened?
I'm going to, you know, they did not take this band lightly. There's no way they did. I look at the music industry, like I had mentioned earlier, as not being very creative at that level. They're not chance takers, you know, they're investors. I don't think they sounded enough like anybody, a major label, was going to be comfortable enough trying to sell. I think they tried with the producers and the engineers and the studios and everybody involved in this to maybe make them sound something that was going on at the time. And it didn't work. And it's not just the labels too. It's consumers and listeners. You know, if listeners and music fans heard this record and thought like, hey, yeah, that's good, but like, I don't know, it doesn't remind me of anybody. This doesn't sound like REO Speedwagon or, you know, like when I was a kid, you know, I was into heavy metal and you would talk about Iron Maiden and Black Sabbath and Judas Priest and, you know, a little later Metallica and things like that. And you could talk about all these bands together. I don't know that this band had a strong group of other bands like that you could lump them in with. And that scares people sometimes.
Here you got this a booyah base of what one might consider to be, or what should be, successful. The label believed in the band because they held on to them for two more records. That's unusual. If your debut doesn't sell, I would think that a label would be like, fuck it, get out, you know?
You know what? That's a really good point, because that even proves further that they didn't know what they were doing. Not only with the band and the record itself, but with their own business model. Because you're right. The first record, if it flops, which this did commercially, it didn't go anywhere, yeah, they're just going to cut them. You know, they're going to drop them from the label and not give them an opportunity to record two more records. Why? So they can duplicate the same, you know, mistakes from the previous one? So, yeah, they were ill-equipped to help this band the way they were supposed to, even though, and this is where we'll give them credit, like you just did, they did believe in them at first. A lot of times with labels, and I don't know the ins and outs of their hiring process or who was around in the office of MCA at the time and who was assigned to work on this, but you have people who believe in a record and believe in a signing, send the band into the studio, and then by the time that record is done, you could have a complete overhaul of the office workers and the people who actually believed in them. Yeah. And so now new people in those positions might not care so much about this record. Maybe they didn't like it. Maybe that's why it wasn't pushed, if that's the case. That's another part of all this, all the behind-the-scenes stuff that a lot of people don't know. Sure. Or realize.
Within a business structure as large as, you know, a major label, you know, you have all of the departments within that structure. And all of those have to fire in a very perfect sequence in a very short period of time.
Yep.
When you've just finished the record. And invariably, one of those people would be on vacation or whatever. So if there's a break in that chain, you're done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that's a problem. And there's also, you know, a problem within the industry where a lot of these executives manage to fail upwards. It's possible for them to, oh, all right, well, that didn't work, but I got promoted and I went to somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then you lose your guy, or you lose your, you know, the person, the linchpin, the person who had a direct relationship with the band, and now they're gone. And now another person, they've been replaced, and that person doesn't want to deal with you because you're not his guys. And so he doesn't want to credit to land on someone else's lap. So that's a huge problem that still exists. Now the bands are sort of the commodity Whereas, and the people in the industry are the rock stars. You know, it's just the way it is. They expect you to do certain things, and then the band doesn't have any recourse because, again, we don't have any leverage. You know, if we don't do it, the next guy will.
Hindsight is always 20/20, right? Knowing what I know now, not what I knew then. I was an idiot then. So would you agree that if we had to list two things that caused the Broken Homes debut album to be abandoned and forgotten about, because you can't find it on any streaming service, it's long out of print, I don't even think a CD was printed of it or pressed of it, and it's weird to be doing a podcast about an album that's not available, yet here we are. So would you agree that if we had to list two things that were an issue for the Broken Homes self-titled debut, my two things would be marketing and record label confusion?
Yeah, I do agree with what you just said. I would phrase it differently from my end, though, because I would call it, I'm going to add something. I would definitely say record label mismanagement, incompetence, for sure, which in my mind includes marketing. The other one I do believe is timing, too. They were ahead of their time, and the time that this music was coming out, other things were happening and selling, and they just weren't really a part of that.
Keith sent me the whole record, and I would listen to it, and I was like, this does not sound like an 80s band.
It was just a little bit ahead. 90s rock, that was guitars and production and stuff like that. And I think we were just a few years before all that was more mainstream.
To your point, Don, that album is one of the reasons I love it for, 35 years now, is that it still sounds as fresh as it did in 1986, to me.
That's a timeless record. It's timeless.
It really is.
That record is about as real as it gets, you know? Luckily, we captured it, and we got great performances, and they're captured. They're not going anywhere. They're not going to get stale.
I quite literally could talk about this album for hours, but that's about all the time we have. Guys, thanks so much for giving up a little bit of your time and talking about the record with us. Really appreciate it. And providing the insight into the record. So, Jeff, what are you up to these days?
Since I moved to New York, I lasted in the management thing about 4 years. I was managing like 5 major label bands, and I just could not take it. It was just too cutthroat. I hated it. So I went back to playing. I stayed in New York, went back to playing bass, picked up upright bass because that's what you got to do in New York City. And then I just finished producing a Brooklyn singer-songwriter named Linda Draper, whose record will come out in January. Female singer-songwriter, a little bit country, a little bit rock, that kind of stuff. So I'm doing the same thing I've always done, basically.
How about you, Don?
Well, I have an ensemble that has been on hiatus since we played our live record release in March of 2020, and that's March of 2020. That's the last time I played the drums live. So, but I have a real estate career I've been doing for like 18 years. Grown kids. My life doesn't revolve around music anymore, but I still love to write music and play music, but I only do it for my own pleasure. That's it.
Craig, what's going on with you?
I live in the Bahamas, which accounts for the shoddy internet. and I've been playing with Lenny Kravitz for 30 years now, almost.
Wow.
And he's got a studio here, and now I'm engineering the records as well. And
oh, that's awesome, man.
Yeah, it's come a long way, which is really funny because I think back to those old records. You know, I never paid attention to the console or anything, and now I'm like, oh, I wonder what console we use. I can't remember.
Jeff would know.
It was an API.
API. Cool. You know, now I'm interested in that side of things, and I've been just touring and writing and recording with Lenny pretty much for years.
That's fantastic. What a great career. What a fantastic thing.
Yeah, it worked out really good. And he's a cool guy, and it's all great.
He got a good guitar player, man, that's for sure.
I mean, the cool thing is it's not that much different than, you know, when it was the other band. I still kind of do the same thing. You know, so.
And Jimmy, what are you up to?
I'm moving to Italy. You know, you go and you play a club. They freaking love it. You know, they adore and they appreciate the effort that you made to get there. You know, mm-hmm. and they appreciate what you do more essentially. You know, they really do. So they, you know, it's a lot more fun, man. You know, it's not as bad of a struggle. And I do, you know, growing up there, I learned the language, and it's a friendly place, man. And Los Angeles or sometimes America seems to be less friendly.
Original drummer Craig Aronson would leave his drum kit behind as he exited Broken Homes and created a name for himself in the music business as an A&R representative. Aronson signed bands like Jimmy Eat's World, My Chemical Romance, Against Me, among many others. Unfortunately, Aronson passed away in 2014 after a long battle with cancer. After the demise of Broken Homes, Mike Doman continued writing and playing music. Unfortunately, he passed away in December of 2020. His legacy continues with the Michael Doman Artists Foundation, run by his brother, Mark Doman. So there you have the members of Broken Homes and the players that went into making the Broken Homes debut record, released in August of 1986 and abandoned by 1987. Thanks for listening. Many thanks to Mark Doman, Craig Ross, Jimmy Ashurst, Jeff Eirich, and Don Harvey. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Sage Sound Studios. The show was produced by Keith R. Higgins and engineered and mixed by Nathan Sage. Written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki. Original music by Mike Pellegrino. The Broken Home songs you heard during this episode were I'll Be Wearin' Blue, In Another Land, Painless Saturday, Steel Town Blues Town, L.A. Rain, and Yes, It's All Over Now. If you like what you hear, please give us a like and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. On Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums. On Instagram, we are at abandoned_album.
I got a lot all the time in the world for both of the people who like that record.
Grazie. Daily Leaf. Rob Janicki. Mike Pellegrino. Therina Vella. Ronnie Barnett. S.W. Loudon, Michael Janicki, Peyton Janicki, and our executive producer,
Rufus Thunderwolf.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Paw Print Media.